Welcome to Ghostbusters, the radio show that talks about strange things in the neighborhood and weird stuff that don't look good. Talk about stuff that's messing with your head and crazy stuff that's happening in the bed. Why? Because many church folks are falling in the darkness. Bible calls us to walk as children of light. The Bible says, see then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time, because the days are evil. Welcome, 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 ladies and gentlemen, to Ghostbusters, the radio show that talks about strange things in the neighborhood and weird stuff that don't look good. Ladies and gentlemen, back in the 60s and the 70s, all the way up to, I think, about 1992 or 93, there was a man by the name of Tom Skinner. And Tom Skinner was a trailblazer. He was a trailblazer as it relates to biblical teaching and racism and world evangelism. And he blazed the trail for a lot of you conservative Bible teachers today. When you think of guys like Dr. Tony Evans and John Jenkins, those guys, they sit at the feet of Tom Skinner. And Tom Skinner was the one that really influenced them in their teaching and in their preaching. So get close to your radio. He's going to be talking today about racism and world evangelism. So get close to your radio and listen.
I have heard Tom Skinner speak to both whites and blacks, and I have been tremendously impressed by what he has said to both groups. He tells it like it is to both groups. There are many things that he says that we don't like, black and whites together, but the question isn't whether we like them. The question is whether they're true. And Tom is a man upon whom the hand of God is. Many Christians have been awakened to the problems that they are responsible before God to have a share in solving. And many non-Christians have come to realize that Jesus Christ is the only answer. He's a man that we're very thankful is here with us tonight. He's written a number of books that are available over in the armory. And he's a man that we're looking forward to God's message from tonight. His message, as you will know, or subject from the title, is U.S. Racism and World Evangelism. Tom, we're glad to have you, and we're looking forward to the Lord's word through you.
I would ask you in the moments that I will share with you this evening that you seek as much as possible to follow everything that I say. It is very difficult because the human mind is able to comprehend something like 300 words a minute, and the human voice can only speak somewhere about 150 words a minute, which means the human mind misses a lot that the human voice says, and so much of what the human voice says is taken out of context. Therefore, I'm going to ask that you judge everything I say in context of the whole message. Now, there's already been some attempt in this convention to put me in direct opposition to previous speaker, and I want you to know that that is not the case. There are people here who present different points of view, but our strategy is simply the same. We are interested in finding means by which we can communicate the Lordship of Jesus Christ in the world. And that many of us come with many of us come from different disciplines and different backgrounds, as you will soon discover, but nevertheless we are committed to that strategy. Any understanding of world evangelism and racism in our country must begin with an understanding of the history of racism. To understand why we are in the middle of a revolution in our time, to come to grips with what the Black Revolution is all about, and to understand what the nature of racism in our society is, I must take you back approximately 350 years to when the early ships landed in this country in approximately 1619. On those ships were approximately 40 black people. Notable among them was a couple known as Isabel and Anthony, who sired the first black family in American soil in 1624. So that you must keep in mind that 1 year before the Mayflower, 150 years before the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence was ever signed in this country, black people had settled this country and were an integral part of this society. Between the periods of 1619 and 1660, there was relatively no race problem in our country, but rather our country had what was known as indentured servanthood. This was where a person who came from the old world, who could not afford to pay his passage to the new world, was bought out by someone of means. He came to this country and worked for that individual for 7 years as an indentured servant, something like Jacob did with his father-in-law. And at the end of 7 years, he was set free to develop his own life. Now keep in mind in that context that those people who in the name of God seek to say that America was founded on godly principles and that our country was started by God-fearing people and that the people who settled our country were men who were deeply committed to the truths of God's word, one must re-examine that in light of the fact that the jails of England were emptied in order to bring people here to this country to settle it. The state of Georgia is a classic example. The state of Georgia was first settled by prisoners from England whom the English wanted to get off their hands, sold them to wealthy people for whom they worked for 7 years and finally were set free to develop their own lives. So if you have any illusions that America was founded on godly principles, re-examine that. It is in this understanding, then, that we also understand that between the periods of 1619 and 1660, black and white people worked together, black and white people were indentured servants, black and white people owned indentured servants, black and white people lived together, ate together, slept together, fought each other, killed each other, sued each other, married each other, took each other to court, murdered each other, and pretty well lived together with each other. So as you see, there was no problem. But in 1660, there arose a tremendous problem, and that was that white indentured servants tended to run away. It was very easy, very difficult to recapture those white indentured servants who ran away because they could easily assimilate into the majority society. When black people ran away, it was very easy to recapture them because of their high degree of visibility. It was therefore decreed in 1660 that only black indentured servants would be used. By 1702, slavery became a permanent way of life in American society. Now let's understand that slavery was upheld by three sectors of society. First, it was upheld by the political system, secondly, by the economic system, and thirdly, by the religious system. It was upheld by the economic system because slavery was economically feasible. A good, healthy male slave could be bought for $600, a healthy female for $300. You had them cohabit, and within several years, you could breed a prosperous group of slaves. What is upheld by the economic system is generally upheld by the political system in our country because you must keep in mind that politics and economics in our country are synonymous. They are parallel to each other. What happens in the economic world affects the political world. If you check out the state of politics in our country previous to the 1968 election, you will notice that when Richard Nixon was nominated at the Republican convention, the Dow Jones Industrial Average went up 11 points. The day before the election, when the polls showed that Mr. Humphrey was narrowing his margin on Mr. Nixon, the stock market reacted by backtracking. If something happens in the political world, it affects the economic world. And you must keep in mind that in our country, only 1% of the total population of this country controls the entire economic system. 1% of all the companies in our country produce 70% of all the wealth. 1% of all the people in our country have 46% of all the outstanding cash. And no matter what they tell you about people's capitalism in our country, that everyone can have a piece of American society, it really boils down to the fact that 90% of all outstanding common stock in this country is controlled by 5% of all the stockholders. It is those people who make the political decisions. It is those people who, in the smoke-filled rooms of political conventions, nominate who they want, and at election time, issue two of them to us to decide which one we'd like. But the third sector that upheld slavery was the religious system. Numerous churches and denominations preached that slavery was a divine institution ordained by God. There were those who quoted a verse in the book of Genesis where Noah is supposed to have gone to bed drunk one night. He was also naked. His son Canaan marked his nakedness the following morning when Noah discovers what his son has done. He curses his son. A group of ad hoc biblical dispensationalists argue that Canaan was a descendant of Ham. The word Ham means black. Therefore, God has cursed all black people and relegated them to conditions of servitude. And incidentally, I can name to you right now at least 5 Christian colleges and at least a dozen Bible institutions in this country that still teach that in their classrooms today. During slavery, the slave master allowed no marriages, and where he did, they were only temporary, and they were usually pronounced with the words, "Do you promise to stay together until death or distance do you part?" Rather, the slave master developed what was known as the stud system, where a healthy male slave was forced to cohabit with a healthy female slave in order to bear healthy children. When the woman became pregnant, he was moved to another quarters to do the same thing, and within the course of 10 years, he could have brought into the world 100 children, but never allowed to father any of them. Very few children went around the plantation saying mommy or daddy because they didn't know who they were. Now keep in mind that numbers of slave masters were also Christians. These same slave masters, many of them deacons and elders in their own local churches, would have never tolerated sexual immorality in their own church, but found no difficulty in putting a black slave woman and a black slave man under immoral conditions together for the purpose of breeding slaves to maintain the economic system. Slavery finally came to an end with the proclamation, with the declaration that they were free, the Emancipation Proclamation. But keep in mind that all the Emancipation Proclamation said was that he is no longer a slave. The proclamation never defined him as a man. It simply said he is not a slave. Between the periods of 1865 and 1877, the society then turned to this former slave and said, "Now that you are free, you are to settle down, become the husband of one wife, the father of your own children, and you are to assimilate into American cultural society." And they expected this former slave to undo in one night what he had been taught to do 250 years another way, and the amazing part about it was that he began to do it. Between the periods of 1865 and 1877, numerous black people were elected to state legislatures in South Carolina, Florida, Mississippi, Alabama, North Carolina, and Louisiana. A black man was governor of the state of Louisiana in that period. The speakers of the House and the state legislatures in 1876 in South Carolina and Florida were black. Black politicians controlled numerous state legislatures throughout the South. Scores of them were elected to the United States Senate and Congress, and they began to make a tremendous upsurge in political power. But by 1877, there developed cries from certain sectors of society which said that this former slave is moving too far too fast. They said he has only been free for 12 years. Does he expect to have all of his marbles in 12 years? These people must learn that these things take time. They must learn to be patient. They cannot have everything at once. Now that was 93 years ago. When was the last time you heard that statement? In 1877, the United States presidential election was thrown into the House of Congress. Mr. Hayes, in order to be elected, entered into a compromise with Southern politicians in which he promised that if elected, he would withdraw troops from the South, end Reconstruction, and allow white people to deal with black people in their own way. It is ironic that that compromise was put in black and white and signed and sealed in the Alexander Hotel of Washington, D.C., which at that time was owned and operated by black men. In 1877, Mr. Hayes was elected. Troops were withdrawn from the South, and white political leaders began to deal with black people in their own way. And from 1877 to almost the present, there began a wave of lynchings and murders and drownings and disappearances of black people unequaled in the history of the Western world. Black people were lynched by the thousands, their homes burned, their women raped, their children beaten, and he could not go to court or fight the issues. He was looked upon as property and not as a human being. He could be put to death for looking at a person too long, for being too familiar with a white person, or wanting to do dumb illegal things like vote. In 1914, World War I came, and the black man put on an American uniform and went off to defend America as the land of the free and the home of the Boston Braves. As a result, he became stationed in the armed services in the northern metropolitan cities, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia. And word began to trickle back to the South, where then 90% of the black population lived, that if black people would migrate north, they would find greater economic opportunity and social justice. Between the periods of 1920 and 1950, there was a mass movement of black people to northern cities. Songs like "So Long, Dixie" developed. The North became the promised land, and by the thousands, people made their way to the northern city in hope that there would be liberation. But when they arrived north, they discovered that the patterns of segregation were no different from the South, that they were forced to live in certain communities. They could only buy, sell, or rent in certain neighborhoods. They soon discovered that integration in the North was defined as that period of time between when the first black family moves into a neighborhood and the last white family moves out. During this period of time, you must keep in mind that in general, there were some notable exceptions. But in general, the evangelical, Bible-believing, fundamental, orthodox, conservative church in this country was strangely silent. In fact, there were those people who, during slavery, argue, it is not our business to become involved in slavery. Those are social issues. We have been called to preach the gospel. We must deliver the word. We must save people's folks, souls. We must not get involved in the issues of liberating people from the chains of slavery. If they accept Jesus Christ as their Savior, by and by they will be free over there. And for a great extent, the evangelical church in America supported the status quo. It supported slavery. It supported segregation. It preached against any attempt of the black man to stand on his own two feet. And where there were those who sought to communicate the gospel of black people, it was always done in a way to make sure that they stayed cool. We will preach the gospel to those folks so they won't riot. We will preach the gospel to them so that we keep the lid on the garbage pail. And so they were careful to point out such scriptures as "obey your masters." Those scriptures which said, "love your enemy, do good to them that hurt you." But no one ever talked about a message which would also speak to the oppressor. It was during this period that my own parents found their way from Greenville, South Carolina, to the city of New York, where I was born and raised. I was born in a little community called Harlem, which is typical of most black communities throughout America. Harlem is a small 2.5 square mile area with a population of almost 1 million people. The social scientists tell us that if you took the entire population of the United States of America, all 200 million Americans, and you forced every American citizen to live somewhere in New York still would not get as congested as Harlem is right now. It was in that community that I was born and raised in a fairly religious home, religious to the extent that my old man is a preacher and that makes me a preacher's kid. But don't feel too bad about it, I got through it. I went through the motions because it was expected of me, but I never bought any of it, basically like a great number of black people, because I could not reconcile Christianity with the kind of community that Harlem was. Harlem was more than 40% slums. Thousands of people lived in rat-infested, run-down, dilapidated apartments that the landlords never came around to provide services for. It was not uncommon for some mother to wake up in the middle of the night and send a piercing scream through the community as she discovered that a 2-week-old baby had been gnawed to death by a vicious rat. You could set your watches to when the police would drive into the neighborhood to collect their bribes to keep the racketeering going. Now, doing this great upsurge and revolution and rebellion that's been going on, there have been great numbers of evangelical Christians who've joined the hoot and cry for law and order. But how do you explain law and order to a mother who stands at the foot of her bed watching her baby lie in a bloodbath when she knows that that baby would have never been bitten by the rat in the first place, and the rat would have never been in the building if the landlord to whom she had been providing, been paying high rent, had been providing the kind of service she deserved for the kind of rent she was paying? How do you explain law and order to her when she knows the building code inspector who represents the city administration, who is supposed to check out violations in buildings, was by that building the day before, was met at the front door by the landlord, who palmed $100 in his hand, and the building code inspector kept going? Now that is lawlessness. But the point is, we never arrest the landlord. We never lock up the building code inspector. But I tell you who we do lock up. We lock up the frustrated, bitter 16-year-old brother of that 2-week-old sister, who in his bitterness takes to the street, throws a brick at that building code inspector. Then we lock him up and say we gotta have law and order.
All right, we're going to stop the tape right here today, but we're going to pick right back up there tomorrow. That was Tom Skinner, and he was talking about racism and evangelism in America. All right, that's it for today. Thank you for joining us. Listen to us all day long, because we're in your corner right here on Ghostbusters.